as perfectly as the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, indeed was.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Free territory.
Part 3.
During my childhood, the conquest of desert was a dream that took me on a vacation to Patagonia. 200 kilometers on a straight line through the province of La Pampa.
Almost 150 years have passed since the Argentine Republic launched an offensive to expand its borders and dispose the indigenous people of their ancestral lands in the south part of the country. The conquest of the desert was not a trip. It was a campaign of extermination carried out by its two main protagonists, Julio Argentino Roca and Remington Rifles, who came from the United States. Julio Argentino Roca was a 35-year-old young general with a brilliant military career. In 1878, he was Minister of War and Navy. He was the intellectual and material author of the first genocide in the history of Argentina. While he was presenting his plans for the desert campaign to the assembly, he said, "We have 6,000 soldiers who are armed with the latest modern military inventions in order to fight against the 2,000 Indians who have no defense other than dispersion and no weapons other than the primitive spear." Benetton owns 900,000 hectares acquired in a transaction in 1991. During the previous 100 years, an English company registered in Argentina under the name Argentine Southern Land Company had the control of the land. In 1890, just after the end of the desert campaign, then-president Miguel Juarez Celman ceded those 900,000 hectares by decree as the Argentine state wished to populate Patagonia with white Europeans. The land was given away free of charge, without paying a single peso, just due to the commitment to bring in settlers and make investments. The vice president, Carlos Pellegrini, criticized this decision, and Juarez Celman replied in a letter that it was preferable to create an Ireland in Patagonia, to which it was submitted by the negligence of the Tehuelche. Juarez Celman was Roca's brother-in-law. Santiago Maldonado lost his life and disappeared after an action of state repression here in this area. there isn't a centralized government in the structure of Mapuche organization. In historical terms, this culture has given them a great power of military resistance. The Spanish conquistadors could vanish Mayas and Incas, but they couldn't do the same thing to the Mapuche nation. So they had to sign peace treaties recognizing the existence of this nation. As a counterpart, this worldview has prevented processes of broader unity. For centuries, different Mapuche camps have fought among themselves and did not come to an agreement for many times to confront the white man or Winca. But the conquistadors took the most advantage of this opportunity. On the Patagonian plateau lives Eusebio Antiaco. This is the Costa de la Paz. The leader of Mapuche, Sofia Antiaco, joins the meeting. This community has a feature. Eusebio's father created the flag that symbolizes the union of the Mapuche and Tehuelche people. Private funds have advanced over the community territories. Mainly the Lebanese landowners, Meljem and Said Bestin, and the Italian businessperson, Luciano Benetton. In 1997, the provincial state admitted that the land had been improperly fenced. The Wire. It made me think about The Wire. The first Argentine legislation on this element dates back to 1860. The original people that are estimated to have lived 9,000 years before in these territories had never used it. Aldo lives here. He is Eusebio's brother, who provides valuable documentation. In 1940, a commission from the Ministry of Agriculture visited the region to evaluate a possible eviction. In the conclusion, it affirmed that the inhabitants had no working habits and assured that those who lived there had an absolute lack of morals. The report valued the eviction as counterproductive, alleging that expelling the indigenous people would be accompanied by the occupation of other lands susceptible to being exploited, where those inhabitants could provide a better field of action for their bad habits. The commission suggested the convenience of reserving the entire 77,500-hectare colony to accommodate indigenous families, including the 80 who were living there at the time. As a direct consequence of the work of this delegation, 2 years later, the conservative president, Ramon Castillo, decreed to cede 74,432 hectares to be occupied free of charge in the indigenous concentration. Only 6,000 remain as community land out of the 74,000 hectares. Now we walk towards the ranch that is controlled by Benetton. The entire path is within the territory granted by the decree of Ramon Castillo. We must avoid being discovered by the custodians of the territory. We are doing well, the camera cannot capture it, but a sacred bird accompanies our journey. Aldo and Eusebio feel strengthened. After almost 5 hours of walking, we finally entered the territory controlled by Benetton. Eusebio, Aldo, and the rest of the interviewees
have opened the doors of their world to me. They have hosted me and have shared their food and spirituality with me. Racism goes through all this conflict. Dispossession was not recognized by the state, and the mass media misinforms with the same discrimination burden. It is time to return home by the same old desert road. I am no longer a child, and now I feel the state is the infant which cannot sit with these men and women as equals and share mate tea and tortas fritas.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام التودد إلى الناس نصف العقل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, affection towards people is half of intellect.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam with his companions, we find that in response to how we should supplicate to Allah, what we should say to Allah, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam speaks about this idea, and he teaches certain du'as, certain dialogues, certain forms and manners of communication to his companions on how to communicate and have a dialogue with the Almighty Allah. In one such instance, we find that Imam Al-Kadhim teaches his companion to recite thus, O my protector, Allah, I have submitted to you, so do not hand me over to the enemy. I have trusted in you, so do not desert me. I have sought refuge in your vast and easy protection, so do not dismiss me. In this beautiful dua, very short, very concise, but so beautifully profound and full of spirituality and wisdom, Imam Al-Kadhim addresses the Almighty Allah as, O my protector. What better protector can one have than Allah? And then how humbly does Imam Al-Kadhim say, I have submitted to you, O Allah, so do not hand me over to the enemy. For surely if we submit ourselves to Allah, then we are of Allah. We are now the property of Allah. We are under the care and protection of Allah. So why would Allah hand us over to the enemy? And Imam Al-Kadhim says, I have trusted in you, O Allah, so do not desert me. If we trust Allah, how is it possible that Allah will leave us alone, will leave us isolated, will leave us lonely, will desert us? And that too, at the times when we need Allah the most. And finally, Imam Al-Kadhim says, I have sought refuge in your vast and easy protection, so do not dismiss me from you. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is saying there are two hujjat. One is that aql, which is daruni, which is in us, that we have. And then there is aql, which is outside, which is the hujjat of God, which is the proof of God. Because there is a possibility of the internal aql being influenced from outside. The internal aql making an error. If that internal aql makes an error, then you have the imam outside. Because that is why qiyas in our school of thought is not considered as a valid methodology in jurisprudence. So therefore, qiyas is your opinion, your intellectual calculation, but there is hujjat which is outside. That, yes, aql is one of the hujjat. From those four, you have the kitab, you have the sunnah, you have the taqreer masum, qawl masum, you have the Quran, right? And then aql as well, and consensus, which is the ijma. So aql is one of them that is there. But if this aql goes against the hujjat, it is not accepted. So you have the aql daruni, you have the aql which is internal aql, then you have the aql which is outside. And both of them needs to be in harmony for reaching or for that plight towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The emphasis on intellect, the emphasis on knowledge, the emphasis on mannerism, on adab, that's what Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, the imams, promoted and showed in their akhlaq, in their behavior, and approached things. That's why, imam is known as Kazim, who controlled that, who had hilm, which is one of the qualities of God, who had hilm. And At the same time, the empathy that the Imam had, where he took the suffering of his own self, you know, so that others may not suffer.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
President Biden was livid. He had been in office only 2 months and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Zolan Kano Young, Michael Shear, and Eileen Sullivan. The piece is titled Disagreement and Delay, How Infighting Over the Border Divided the White House. President Biden was livid. He had only been in office for 2 months, and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. Facing his bickering staff in the Oval Office, That day, in late March 2021, Joe Biden grew so angry at their attempts to duck responsibility that he erupted. "Who do I need to fire," he demanded, "to fix this?" Joe Biden came into office promising to dismantle what he described as the inhumane immigration policies of his predecessor, Donald J. Trump. But the episode, recounted by several people who attended or were briefed on the meeting, helps explain why that effort remains incomplete. For much of Joe Biden's presidency so far, the White House has been divided by furious debates over how and whether to proceed in the face of a surge of migrants crossing the southwest border of the United States. Senior Biden aides have been battling one another over how quickly to roll back the most restrictive policies and what kind of system would best replace them. Now Mr. Biden finds himself the target of attacks from all sides. Immigration activists accuse him of failing to prioritize the human rights of millions of immigrants. Conservatives have pointed to surges of migrants at the border as evidence that the president is weak and ineffective. And even some moderate Democrats now fear that lifting Trump-era border restrictions could hurt them politically. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security expect record numbers of migrants to cross the border this summer, just months ahead of the midterm elections that will determine control of Congress and help shape the arc of Joe Biden's presidency for the next 2 years. This account of the Biden administration's handling of the border over the past 15 months is based on interviews with 20 current and former officials, lawmakers and activists, most of whom requested anonymity to discuss private deliberations. President Biden came into office with high hopes, saying he wanted a system that would allow the United States to determine in a more compassionate way which migrants should be allowed to stay in the country. He recruited a team of immigration advocates and others eager to put in place the humane system they had envisioned for years. But the slow pace of change has left some of Joe Biden's longtime allies doubting his commitment and wondering whether he is more interested in keeping the highly charged issue from dominating his presidency. Virtually all of the aides who came on board early in the Biden administration have left the White House, frustrated by what they describe as repeated fights with some of the president's most senior advisers over whether to lift Trump-era policies. Even some of Joe Biden's more enforcement-minded aides have departed. White House officials did not dispute the internal disagreements over immigration. Vedant Patel, a spokesman for Mr. Biden, said the president understood that changing an outdated system was not going to happen overnight. Though he said, Joe Biden was working every day to secure our border and use the power we do have to build a fair, orderly and humane immigration system. But the border has been a constant headache for President Biden, one that ballooned into a series of crises even as he tried to stay focused on the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, Afghanistan, and the conflict in Ukraine. Our old debates about border security and deterrence and open borders are not capturing the actual policy challenge at hand, said Andrea Flores, who resigned as a director for border management at the National Security Council, disillusioned and frustrated by senior aides and the opportunities I saw them not take. Ron Klain issued a warning to his staff last summer. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, gathered senior aides, including Susan Rice, the president's domestic policy advisor, Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, the Homeland Security advisor, and Amy Pope, the top migration advisor, in the Roosevelt Room. Ron Klain, told them that they needed to make sure the administration was not pandering to people who wanted an immediate end to Trump-era border restrictions, according to two people familiar with his comments. If they did not find a way to deter soaring illegal crossings at the southwest border of the United States, he said, accusations about border chaos would grow worse, anger moderate voters, and potentially sink the party during the 2022 midterm elections. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, was channeling his boss, who had complained to top aides about the intensifying attacks from Republicans, characterizing him as an open border president, according to a person familiar with Mr. Biden's comments. But the source of President's frustration was as much from inside his administration as it was from outside. As border crossings increased, disagreements erupted over how quickly to dismantle Donald Trump's anti-immigrant policies and what to replace them with. Record numbers of migrants, including people driven out of their homes in Central America by the economic effects of the pandemic, gangs and natural disasters, surged to the border last summer, in part enticed by Joe Biden's promise of a less harsh approach to immigration than that of his predecessor. About 214,000 migrants were taken into custody in July of last year, the first time that many people had been apprehended in a single month in more than two decades. Joe Biden has taken a series of actions to reverse his predecessor's policies. He halted construction of the border wall, created a task force to reunite families separated at the border, and reversed Donald Trump's ban on considering domestic violence or gang violence as a basis for asylum. He also proposed sweeping legislation to overhaul the nation's immigration system, though it has stalled in Congress. But despite those actions, the infighting among the president's aides was on full display during the Oval Office meeting last March. Xavier Becerra, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, whose department runs shelters for migrant children, said the Department of Homeland Security needed to be aggressive in turning away older teenagers, which would have changed President Biden's policy of letting all unaccompanied migrant children into the country. Ms. Rice repeatedly said that Xavier Becerra should provide more shelters. Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said the Department of Health and Human Services needed to move the children more quickly out of overcrowded Border Patrol stations. Ron Klain, the White House Chief of Staff, tried to play the mediator, to little effect. For months, aides clashed over an effort intended to speed up consideration of asylum cases at the border by allowing immigration officers to decide the claims rather than the overburdened judges. The goal was to streamline a court process that currently takes an average of 5 years to reach a decision for asylum seekers. Some of the former immigration advocates in the West Wing, including Ms. Rice's Deputy for Immigration, Esther Olivaria, worried that rushing through the new process would limit due process for migrants. Ms. Rice, Ron Klain, and others argued that processing claims faster, swiftly deporting migrants who failed to win asylum, was an important way to ease the burden on the system and deter illegal crossings. As the year went on, Joe Biden grew annoyed by the delays in putting the asylum changes into practice along the U.S. border with Mexico. In meetings on immigration with his top aides, he often asked what resources and funding the team of former advocates and immigration veterans needed for the policy. The administration did not release the final language for the new policy until last month. And because of staffing and funding issues, the plan will be rolled out slowly and not in time to offer significant help with the expected spike in migrants seeking asylum later on this spring. One of the most fraught debates inside the West Wing over the last year has been what to do about Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which forced migrants seeking asylum to wait south of the border until their cases were decided. Human rights advocates assailed the conditions in Mexico, where migrants often stayed in squalid camps, where they had no legal representation and were at risk of assault. As a candidate, Joe Biden had condemned the program. Once in office, he quickly terminated it. But it was one program that had been effective at keeping some migrants out of border detention facilities. During a meeting last summer convened to discuss options for dealing with the record numbers of migrants at the U.S. border, Ms. Sherwood Randall raised the possibility of restoring the program with some additional protections for migrants, according to two people familiar with the matter. That idea horrified immigration advocates inside the Biden administration, who viewed it not only as a breach of Joe Biden's campaign pledge, but also as a retreat from the promise of a more humane immigration system. Joe Biden, too, appeared uncomfortable with the idea, according to a person who was in the room for the meeting. The president told his team he would not forbid them to explore whether it was worth restoring the Remain in Mexico policy, but he made it clear that he did not want the idea leaking to the news media, and he did not want his name attached to it. The Supreme Court would later force the Biden administration to restore the Trump-era policy.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the non-believers related rules or jurisprudential status according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before that, of course, we're going to take a listen to a short biography. Let's stay with us.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Well, Sheikh Javid, let's talk about the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei about the non-believers or kafir. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a Muslim man or a woman to marry a kafir, a non-believer?
Well, that is one of the issues and one of the questions frequently asked by Muslims living in the West,
mm-hmm.
because they wish they were able to marry, for example, a girl, a Christian girl or the Jewish, there are many Muslims who work with non-Muslims, and sometimes they develop a kind of liking for a non-Muslim and wish to know whether it's permissible or not to marry a Christian woman or not.
Yes.
So again, we have to clarify one thing, and that is we should differentiate between the people of the book and the people who do not believe in any divinely revealed book, of course. So, generally speaking, it is not permissible for a Muslim woman,
mm-hmm.
to marry a non-Muslim man under any circumstances, no matter what the excuse, okay? But when it comes to a Muslim man who is willing to marry a non-Muslim woman, of course, if he is unmarried, and if he does not have a Muslim wife, then it is permissible for him to contract temporary marriage to a Muslim, to a Christian or a Jewish woman. Temporary marriage.
Uh-huh.
So only temporary marriage is allowed and permissible for a Muslim man who is unmarried and who is not already married mm-hmm. to a Muslim woman. And of course, if he is married to a Muslim woman, then there is no doubt that he is not allowed to have a Muslim wife and a non-Muslim wife at the same time.
Uh-huh.
At the same time. and it will not be permissible. Now, when it comes to marrying a non-Muslim woman who does not believe in any divinely revealed book, of course, it's not permissible
under any circumstances.
Yeah, under any circumstances. Now, there are, for example, let's see, Shia Muslims who live in India.
Yes.
So they come across, women, and they want to know whether it's permissible to marry them or not. The religious authorities have stated that if you are very much willing to marry a Hindu woman, you should ask her to recite the two testimonies, mm-hmm. to take Shahada. And once she takes Shahada, then it's permissible for you to marry that woman. Because taking Shahada, that's enough.
Technically, yeah. she becomes a Muslim, right?
Becomes a Muslim woman. Maybe she may not be sincere in her conversion to Islam.
Yes.
And she may not, in the heart of her, she may not be a Muslim, but since she has taken the Shahada, then that makes the marriage permissible. So that will be enough. Even if that woman is not going to be a practicing Muslim woman, mm-hmm.
Are we talking about permanent marriage or temporary marriage?
Both
here?
Permanent and temporary.
I see.
Yeah, both permanent and temporary. Because when she recites the two testimonies, then she becomes a Muslim woman. At least nominally, mm-hmm. she becomes a Muslim.
I see.
A woman, and though it is not, of course, she is not a practicing woman, and it's not advisable for a Muslim man to marry such a woman. But okay, if a man is bent on marrying such a woman,
mm-hmm.
because she, maybe he has fallen in love with such a woman,
yes,
and she cannot forget about that woman, so he can marry her.
This is the way.
Provided that. So the very confession and the very testimony, or what we call shahadatain, mm-hmm. if those two testimonies are recited,
these two phrases, these two expressions, are need to be recited, right? Yes.
So,
and should it be recited in front of, for example, a religious authority or something?
No, a religious scholar? No, that's not a condition,
uh-huh.
If a person takes shahada,
yes.
In a closed room and with no one seeing him, that's enough,
mm-hmm.
because only God knows the truth.
So he doesn't need any kind of witnesses.
No witnesses are required.
Uh-huh.
Yes,
I see.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en in the section Religious Affairs. You can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws regarding the non-believers and non-Muslims. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question. Is someone who denies the clearly defined laws of Islam, if somebody does that, denies it, is he or she considered to be a non-Muslim?
Yeah, a person who denies or rejects the clearly and conspicuous or unambiguous
mm-hmm.
rules of Islam or doctrines of Islam or teachings of Islam, he is deemed to be a kafir. But such a person whose denial is tantamount mm-hmm. to denying the Prophet of Islam, and he rejecting the Prophet of Islam is a non-Muslim, because he has his action and his denial has amounts to denial of the Prophet, and that just takes him out of the fold of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
He's no longer considered to be a Muslim, even if he might want to consider himself a Muslim,
yes,
because he rejects something which is very clearly defined. It is acceptable to all Muslims. And it's well known that that is the teaching of the Prophet. For example, if someone says prayer is not wajib, or prayer, for example, let's say Hajj is not an obligatory, is not obligatory. While the Prophet, peace be upon him, on the other says Hajj is wajib and has tremendous reward.
Mm-hmm.
And the same zakat and all these are some of the main teachings of Islam.
Yes.
If someone, and even within the Hajj, within the prayer, if for example says that, okay, let's say we do believe that the Fajr prayer consists of two rakahs of prayer. Now everybody knows it. It's a clearly defined issue, a clearly defined ruling. And in Arabic terminology, they call it zaruri. Zaruri means, clearly defined, ambiguous, conspicuous, and clear. So if a person...
What about somebody's denying the Quran? So is that considered to be...
Yeah, of course.
Yes, clearly defined law.
Because everybody, all Muslims believe that the Quran is the book of Allah, and it was revealed to the Prophet, and the Prophet, preached it among Muslims, and it's and the codes of conduct are derived from the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Quran is the most important source,
yes,
for derivation and extraction of Islamic laws and practice and code of practice.
I see. What about the Khawarij and Nawasib?
Well, we have a number of so-called Muslims. They consider themselves to be Muslim, but they are not Muslims according to Shia scholars.
Yes.
And even today we have such people, the Khawarij, the Ghulat, Ghulat are the exaggerators. Those are the ones who consider the Imams, or especially Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, as God, as their deity. And the Khawarij are those, rigid and people who lived in the time of the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and who fought him. And the Nawasib, we have the Nawasib who are enemies to the Imams and to the Holy Prophet, and they are the ones who clearly express enmity.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Imams. So these are the enemies of the Prophet, and these are the enemies of the Imams, and they are kafir.
Okay.
They are disbelievers.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Chavi. Thank you for listening to the program Islam Laws on IRIB English Radio. We leave you in Allah's care. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.